Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Good afternoon. This is the Reasonable Voices Talk News Radio Program, and I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. My guest today is John Kiriakou, a former CIA analyst, case officer, a former senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, former counterterrorism consultant, and author of the book Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. And John Kiriakou also appears with fellow political prisoner Ai Weiwei in the NYC documentary directed by a former Reasonable Voices radio guest, curator Cheryl Haynes. While employed by the CIA for 14 years, John Kiriakou was involved in critical counterterrorism missions following the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, but he refused to be trained in what Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques. After leaving the CIA, Kiriakou appeared on ABC News in December 2007 in an interview with Brian Ross, during which John Kiriakou became the first current or former CIA officer to publicly confirm that the CIA used torture. Kiriakou's interview revealed that this practice was not just the result of a few rogue agents, but was official U.S. policy, approved at the highest level of our American government, and that its use was official policy under the Bush-Cheney administration, personally approved by President George W. Bush. Thus, during the Bush-Cheney administration, detained prisoners were waterboarded, and waterboarding, at least to our guest today, constituted torture. In 2012, the Obama administration filed an espionage charges against Kiriakou. So now I'm going to quote John Kiriakou. There are some things we should not do, even in the name of national security. Unquote. Thank you, John Kiriakou, for adding your reasonable voice to the Reasonable Voices News Talk program, and welcome to our show today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure's ours. There's so many questions, so I'm going to jump right in. First, John, I'd like to, well, confirm or deny, did America's policy of torture approved by our government include both Bush-Cheney and Obama-Biden administrations?
We didn't think so. If we are to believe the information that the Senate Intelligence Committee has released, the torture program formally ended in 2005. There were remnants of it that stretched into 2006 or 2007, but it did not make it as far as the Obama administration.
Okay. Please explain to us, if you will, how the Espionage Act, which was enacted, as I understand it, to punish spies, was used to prosecute you as a whistleblower.
That's a very good question, and it's one that I've done a lot of research into. The Espionage Act was passed into law in 1917 to combat German saboteurs.
Mm-hmm.
It was not meant to prosecute Americans who revealed information to the media. So it passed in 1917. It was never updated. In fact, it doesn't even mention the term classified information. It only uses the term national defense information, and then it doesn't define what national defense information is. So between 1917 and 2009, the inauguration of Barack Obama, three Americans were charged with espionage for speaking with the media. In the 8 years of the Obama administration, eight Americans were charged with espionage for speaking with the media. And let me give you an example, too, of how things have changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
When I was still in the CIA, in the mid-1990s, I sat next to a woman who, as it turns out, was having an affair with a CNN commentator. And during the course of pillow talk, she revealed information that was later deemed to be classified. She was not charged with espionage. She was not charged with any crime. Instead, she was suspended without pay for 6 weeks, and she was denied a promotion for 2 years.
Hmm.
That's how the government used to deal with people speaking with the media, in the event that what they were revealing was truly, honestly classified information. Now, one of the other reasons why an Espionage Act charge was such a shock to me, and I was actually charged with three counts of espionage, is that there's a law in this country that makes it a crime to classify a crime. For example, you can't classify a program that is either illegal or that is embarrassing to the government or to the Central Intelligence Agency. I believed in my heart, and I also believe that I've been proven correct, that the CIA's torture program was a crime. And so it was improperly, inappropriately classified.
Well, okay. So you were the sixth whistleblower indicted by the Obama administration under the Espionage Act, this law that was designed to punish spies. But you make an excellent point. It wasn't devised to or enacted to prosecute whistleblowers, but you make an excellent point. We have laws that say you cannot classify illegal acts anyway.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. You can't classify illegal acts anyway. And look at the case of Tom Drake, the NSA whistleblower.
Yes.
Tom Drake, in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, Tom Drake found himself in the Senior Intelligence Service as an executive at NSA. And he realized immediately that NSA was using the 9/11 attacks as an excuse to begin spying on Americans.
Yes.
Now, not only was that illegal, it was also a violation of NSA's charter. The charter itself says that NSA is not permitted to collect the personal information or personal communications of American citizens.
Yes.
So he did exactly what we're taught to do. He went through the chain of command. He went to his supervisor. Supervisor sent him away. He went to the inspector general, who had no idea what he was talking about.
Mm.
He went to the general counsel. Then he went to the Pentagon inspector general.
Yes.
Because NSA is a DOD entity.
Sure.
The Pentagon Inspector General actually destroyed the evidence that Tom brought out with him. And then finally he went to the Congressional Oversight Committee, to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence.
Yes.
And for his trouble, for going through the chain of command and never revealing classified information, he was charged with seven counts of espionage. Of course, he hadn't committed espionage, and every one of those counts was eventually dropped. But not until he lost his job.
Yes.
He lost his security clearance. He lost his pension. He even lost his wife.
Mm.
And in the end, he hadn't done anything wrong in the first place. So what it is the Espionage Act really has become a weapon, a political weapon, that's used against people in the intelligence community who dissent. That dissent is just unacceptable to the government.
And what... You know, that's so difficult to hear, because it's not that I, certainly not since Nixon, I haven't been a starry-eyed guy that believes in everything I saw in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But still, there are things that are being discovered more and more, and of course, in this conversation, that tell us we are not even close to what we claim to be in so many areas. I mean, the people are good and kind and reach in their pockets when, you know, we see things on social media and any other, you know, hurricanes, floods. We are very quick to respond, but we have elected a government too often. Well, that breaks the law. It's no other way of putting it. What recourse do whistleblowers have? I mean, for instance, what is the Government Accountability Project, and how are you involved with that, or are they with you?
Great question. Let me answer your first question first. What do you do in a case like this? There really is no recourse. There are laws that are supposed to protect whistleblowers. We have a federal whistleblower Protection Act, and there's a National Security Whistleblower Protection Act, but they're really not worth the paper they're written on, and there is, in the end, no protection from prosecution for legitimate national security whistleblowers. But there are non-governmental organizations that are helpful. The Government Accountability Project is one. It's the oldest and one of the most important. When I was arrested, I noticed in the Washington Post that attorneys from the Government Accountability Project were repeatedly quoted in newspaper articles about my case, and they were always very favorable.
Mm-hmm.
So I reached out to GAP, and they agreed to represent me in part as sort of my outreach to the media.
Yes.
That was immensely helpful. Now, they're not criminal defense attorneys, certainly. I had to hire those on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But GAP has gone down this road many, many times. They know whistleblowers inside and out, and they're there to help. But there's another organization called POGO, the Project on Government Oversight.
Yes.
That's very helpful, not in national security, but, you know, the whistleblower, the Treasury Department, or agriculture, or EPA, or whatever. POGO is also very good. Otherwise, there's not much. There's a new organization called the WHISPR Project. It stands for Whistleblower and Source Protection Project. It's led by two attorneys who used to constitute the national security group at the Government Accountability Project. Otherwise, you're really on your own. And the shame is, you know, there's even a whistleblower caucus on Capitol Hill. And I laugh every time I say that, because everybody wants to say that they are supportive and protective of whistleblowers. And then when you actually blow the whistle on something and go to Capitol Hill and seek support, all you hear are crickets. There's really only one member of Congress who has made whistleblower protection a cause, including national security whistleblowing, and that is Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa.
Oh, yes.
Otherwise, there's nobody talking about these issues.
So I guess, at the very least, we get from this that Trump's attempt to publicly identify and attack the whistleblower who ignited the House impeachment inquiry is not by any means the first time this has happened.
No, not at all. It's quite a common occurrence. It's funny, the knee-jerk reaction, whether it's Donald Trump in the White House or Barack Obama or George W. Bush, is to attack and discredit the whistleblower.
Yeah. Gee. There's more to it than just being appalled at the self-serving quality of that. There's more to it than that. It's about our foundation. It goes to our belief in ourselves, an honor system, if you will, our laws.
Yes.
That's what's so, well, anyway.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny too, because this is not a complicated issue, nor is it a partisan one.
Yes.
There's a legal definition of whistleblowing, and that is bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. Who could be against that?
Yeah.
It really is a public service. But then, when you get into the use of the Espionage Act,
mm-hmm.
and you have to go to court to defend yourself in a criminal trial, there's no such thing as an affirmative defense. So you are not permitted to get up there on the stand and say, I did it for the American people. I did it because the program was illegal. I did it because it was the right thing to do. You're not allowed to say those words.
And why not?
Because that's the law. The law doesn't allow, the Espionage Act does not allow for an affirmative defense.
Yeah.
When Edward Snowden went public with his revelations, I wrote him an open letter that was covered heavily in the media, and I followed it up with a private letter that a mutual friend delivered for me. And I told him he needs to hire the best attorneys money can buy. Mm. And he ended up hiring my attorney, which was great. But he also was adamant that he be allowed to present an affirmative defense. Ed Snowden was not afraid to come back and face trial. Mm-hmm. He was not afraid to come back and go to prison. He told me so himself.
Uh-huh.
But he wanted to do it after being able to stand up in court and to explain why he did what he did. And the judge said that that would never happen. And that's why he's still sitting in Moscow.
Oh, my God. Listen, there's much more to talk about, and we have a little more time in this segment, but I'm going to go to a break. This has been such eye-opening information and conversation with our guest today, former CIA analyst and case officer John Kiriakou. And I want to leave you with this bit of a cliffhanger, if we can. After the commercial break, we're going to ask John how he was able to avoid an espionage trial, since he's described it in such vivid clarity that he wouldn't have even been able to defend himself. So stay with us. We'll be right back with John Kiriakou.
And now enjoy Watchfire Music featuring vocal artist Jenny Burton singing Tear Down the House from Is Anybody Listening?
Tear it up.
For all now, we'll build it for the child in you. Innocent hearts now, we'll build it. We'll build it for all the world to
you.
What's in the past, those who built it did the things they had to do.
The highest intention.
But something happened along the way. Something happened along the way. Something managed to go astray. It's true. Now we gotta tear down the house. Tear it down. We better build it back up on a higher ground. Oh yeah. Tear down the house. Tear it up.
Tear it up.
And start it
again.
If you're gonna
tear down the house,
we must respect and guard life. Yeah, we gotta change this.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. My guest today is John Kiriakou. John was a CIA analyst and case officer. He's a former senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and former counterterrorism consultant. He's the author of the book Doing Time Like a Spy: How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. And as we went off the air at the end of the first segment, I said I was going to ask John to tell us how, with everything he's already told us of how the Espionage Act of 1917 has been sort of skewed into this all-purpose get the people who are against you and go after them in any way you can, and this is coming from very highest levels in government. So, John, how on earth did you avoid the espionage trial?
Well, I have the truth on my side, number one, and I was lucky. On the other hand, I was charged with 3 counts of espionage, and I knew I hadn't committed espionage, but you're in such a state of shock when you're arrested and charged with this grave crime. This is really one of the most grave crimes with which an American can be charged, and it frequently carries with it the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And so... So a couple of days after my arrest, the Justice Department prosecutors came to my attorneys and said that they were offering me 45 years. Take a plea to an espionage charge, get 45 years, and I might live to meet my grandchildren, they said.
Wow.
And I said, I haven't done anything wrong, and I'm not doing 45 minutes. and we just shut it down. They came back a couple of weeks later with an offer of 10 years. Take a guilty plea to an espionage charge, and I get 10 years. I rejected that. Then they came down 2 days later to 8, and 2 days later after that to 5. And my lead attorney said, you know, I've been practicing law here for 53 years.
Yes.
And I've never seen them come down in time.
Yes.
Usually they'll offer you 10. If you turn that down, they go to 15. They go to 20 after that. Not down in time.
Yes.
And I said, why do you think they're going down? And he said, if I'm able to say this on the air, he said, they have a shit case and they know it's shit.
Yes.
He said, we're going to trial. And so we headed toward trial. Well, the truth of the matter is that I hadn't committed espionage.
Mm.
And as I said, I believed that the torture program was illegal. It was patently illegal. And we were prepared to subpoena George W. Bush's classification czar.
Mm.
He was in charge of the classification of all documents in the U.S. government. And we had asked him, and he had agreed, to testify that the program was illegally and improperly classified. Well, the Justice Department said that they would fight us on that. And finally, I said, fine. Then go ahead and charge me with espionage. I'm going to plead not guilty. I'm going to testify on my own behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going to talk about the hideous crimes against humanity and war crimes that I witnessed in 15 years at the CIA.
Yes.
And then they came back and they said, all right, 2.5 years, you do 23 months. We drop the espionage charges. You know, ProPublica came out with a study in November of 2012 in which they found that the federal government wins 98.2% of their cases. So I have this offer of 23 months now. Do I roll the dice knowing that I have a 1.8% chance of winning and possibly getting 45 years? I said to my lawyers, I said, I think I'm going to turn down the 23 months. I didn't do anything wrong, and I want to go to trial. If I lose, realistically, what am I looking at? And they said, realistically, you're looking at 12 to 18 years.
Mm.
And so I took the deal. I had 5 children at home.
Sure.
And one of my lawyers pulled me aside, the one who I liked and respected the most. I had 11 attorneys, if you can imagine.
Good heavens.
And he pulled me aside and he said, look, this can be a blip in your life or it can be the defining event in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Make it the blip. Take the deal. And so I took the deal.
Oh, man, John, no one should have to go through that. And I think we should remind people, because you've mentioned that in some cases there was a death penalty, the Rosenbergs were... that was their charge, you know, and we should remind people, it's been a long time, but it's still very much part of American history, obviously.
Indeed, it is, and it's still on the books.
Yes.
It's still on the books, and so if the Justice Department wants to charge you with a death penalty case where no one has been harmed, where the law doesn't even define what national defense information is, you can still be found guilty and sentenced to death.
Yes.
That's why this law needs to be rewritten.
Yes. There's so much, I must say, you know, I'm not a Trump supporter by any means, but I keep telling my friends and my political circle and beyond that one thing we need to do is say thank you, Mr. Trump, because he has pointed out more than most presidents where we need to be making a lot of changes. We believe that, especially those who, you know, followed Supreme Court Justice Scalia, that the Constitution, this wonderful document, is,
yes,
you know, it's forever. It's chiseled in stone. We shouldn't touch it. But the reality is we've amended the Constitution in the past. And
many times.
Yes, many times. And to call something when you know, what is the term, the 1917 term for it? You've said it several times that if you're guilty.
National Defense Information.
Yes, National Defense Information. And you don't even define it. So clearly we need to amend it at least enough to define it, to be clear what it is you're being charged with. Okay.
Let me add something to that, because that's a very important point. And, you know, your listeners may ask, well, why hasn't anybody who's been convicted of espionage appeal? to try to get the thing overturned as unconstitutionally brought. Well, the fact of the matter is, it's because everybody takes a plea. And a standard part of every plea agreement with the Justice Department is that you waive your right to any future appeal.
Yes.
So there are only two living people who have the standing to challenge the constitutionality of the Espionage Act, and that's Chelsea Manning and Jeffrey Sterling. And I've spoken to both of them about this, and the sad truth is that they're both flat broke, and
yes,
they just don't have it in them to challenge their convictions to the Supreme Court.
Another sad truth, if I may, John, that there are enough of you now that you brainstorm, you mastermind.
Yes.
You know
it's
what
like
I mean?
We have a club.
I know. Gee, it's not. And I don't mean it to be funny. I know you know that, but it's just my goodness. There are these people living in limbo, and many who've had their whole lives taken away from them. And
yeah.
You know what? Do this for me, if you don't mind, John. How would you define? And I know you did touch on this. You have, but I want to ask it. To just so it can stand on its own, how would you define a whistleblower as opposed to a spy?
Yes. Let me preface it by telling you a short story. When I got out of prison in 2015, I was hired by the Greek government to help them write a new whistleblower protection law. And so I made many trips to Greece. I went 5 times in 2015. And in one of these meetings, I was sitting with the Minister of Justice, and we were going over the basic points of the proposed law. My Greek is good, so we were speaking in Greek, but there's no Greek word for whistleblower. And so I would say the word in English. And finally, he said to me, "What exactly is this word that you keep using, whistleblower?" So I explained to him what it was. And he said, "Oh, you mean like a rat or a snitch."
Oh, my God.
And I said, "No, not at all like a rat or a snitch." And so that led to a very spirited conversation. And we decided to use a Greek word. It's a lovely word that means sentinel of the public trust. And so that was the word that we put in the law. And it's because most Americans don't know the difference between a whistleblower on the one hand, a rat, a snitch, or a spy on the other hand. Like I said earlier, there is that legal definition of a whistleblower. It's any person who brings to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. And one of the interesting tenets of that is that motivation is irrelevant. And so maybe you don't like Chelsea Manning. You say, well, Chelsea Manning's not a whistleblower because the only reason she released all that information is because she didn't want to be in Kuwait anymore. That's irrelevant. What Chelsea Manning released was evidence of a war crime. And so Chelsea Manning, whether you like her politics or not, is a whistleblower.
That's right. You know, I'm curious why you were the only CIA agent to go to jail in connection with the U.S. torture program. I mean, everybody was doing it. I mean, I put it in so trite, but why were you singled out, do you think?
Well, for a couple of reasons. CIA officers with whom I worked told me that that I would never be forgiven for airing the dirty laundry, that I should never have gone public, that I embarrassed the CIA. And as you said in your introduction of me, I was one of 14 people who was asked if I wanted to be trained in the use of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. I was the only one of the 14 who said no. I was immediately branded as the human rights guy. And believe me, that did nothing to further my career. And then when I finally went public, and I didn't go public right away. I waited for 5.5 years before I went public because I kept waiting for somebody who was actually involved in the torture program to go public. And no one ever said a word.
Well, it takes a lot of courage to be you, John. You know,
thank you.
And again, I'm not being flippant. We know your story even before today, and I'm glad you're sharing it today. I wonder, we heard so much, of course, about Guantanamo during the Bush-Cheney administration, but Obama, in part, was elected because he was going to close it, and then he was unable to. And I'm not certain that it was because he didn't try. After all, there are other ways of torture and places of torture people, so let's face it.
Sure.
They have been used. even since Bush Cheney. But what's the status? Because it sort of disappeared off the public radar, and I'm sure that's intentional, in addition to Americans have a short attention span. What's the story with Guantanamo? Are we still holding people there? Are we torturing them?
Oh, we sure are. Yeah, not a lot, a few dozen. They call them the worst of the worst. But yeah, you know, let me tell you also the origins of Guantanamo.
Uh-huh.
When we began capturing Al-Qaeda prisoners in February of 2002, I didn't know what to do with them once we started catching them. And so I cabled CIA headquarters and I said, look, we're starting to fill the jails up here in Pakistan.
Wow.
And I don't know what to do with all these people. What do you want me to do with them? And I was told to put them on a C-12 transport plane and send them to Guantanamo. And I said, Guantanamo, Cuba?
Yes.
And the answer was, yeah, we're gonna put them in Cuba. We're going to leave them there for a couple of weeks, maybe as long as a couple of months, until we can identify the appropriate federal district in which to try them. And I said, oh, well, that's a great idea. So they'll go to Guantanamo, and then we'll send them on to either Washington, New York, or Boston, which is where the 9/11 investigations were being conducted.
Since yes.
That's where the planes were hijacked. Well, that's a great idea, I thought. Mm. They'll only be there for 3, 4, 6 weeks.
Yes.
And then that wasn't it at all. So we still have these so-called worst of the worst who are in Guantanamo. The problem is that we can't put them on trial for any crime because their confessions were all obtained through torture.
Yes.
And so even the military commissions have said that it's virtually impossible for any of them to have a fair trial. Now, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, has tried repeatedly to force a military tribunal. But here we are, 17 years after his capture, slightly
yes.
more than 17 years. And he's no closer to a trial now than he was then.
Mm-hmm. You know, in your book, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison, you write that torture doesn't work, and here's an example of you've just given us. And you describe torture as un-American. How's your book doing? Are enough people reading it to get the message?
You know, I was proud of this one. It won the Penn First Amendment Award, which is one of the big four literary awards in the country, along with the Pulitzer Prize, the Penn Faulkner, and the Edgar Allan Poe. And it sold out the first edition.
Yes.
So it's gone to paperback now.
Excellent. And I knew that. But I have to... It's just that when we... During this conversation, I kept wondering, has anybody read his book? But but I guess those who need it most haven't. I don't know. But I also want to touch on this weekend. We know President Trump excused his not telling Speaker Pelosi about his plans to capture and kill an ISIS leader. All that's good, I guess,
yeah.
Because Washington, D.C. leaks more than any place else in the world. So first, are leaks still so prevalent? And if so, why were you prosecuted for leaking classified information?
Right.
Yeah, tell me.
Well, you know, the most prolific leakers in America are in the White House.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I'm glad you said it.
Washington Post and New York Times couldn't do their jobs day to day if it weren't for leaks. And in fact, you know, I was convicted of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1981.
Yes.
I confirmed the name of a former colleague to a journalist who was writing a book and wanted to interview him. And I got 2 years in prison for it. But David Petraeus, the former director of the CIA, leaked the names of 10 covert CIA operatives to his adulterous girlfriend.
Yes.
In order to impress her.
Yes.
He was charged with a misdemeanor. And he got 18 months of unsupervised probation. He didn't even lose his security clearance. So,
yeah.
You know, these cases are entirely political.
Yes.
Scott Shane, a reporter for the New York Times, said that on the day of my arrest, every one of the New York Times national security sources went silent. And that was the purpose of my prosecution.
Mm.
It was to make an example of me so that if you have something that you want to reveal to the press that is embarrassing to the intelligence community, you're going to go to prison. Now, if you want to leak something that makes the president look like a superstar or the CIA look like a bunch of geniuses, go ahead and leak away.
Yeah.
That's going to get on the front page of the papers and everybody's going to be happy. But if you want to report waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, you're taking your life into your hands.
Yeah, quite literally. You know, early on in segment one, I mentioned the documentary, Ai Weiwei, Yours Truly, which is about the exhibit of the outspoken artist and activist Ai Weiwei at the former island penitentiary Alcatraz. Now,
yes.
Ai Weiwei was detained by Chinese authorities, and one of his artworks, Yours Truly, invited the public to compose messages on postcards to prisoners of conscience around the world,
yes,
so they could write about human rights and personal freedom. And I just wonder, I've been curious since I saw you in that, did you receive one of those postcards by any chance?
I received about 2,000 of those postcards.
Wow.
And it's funny, they started arriving about 6 weeks before I left prison. On the first day, just one arrived. And I looked at it, and it was an anonymous postcard. It said something like, you are not forgotten.
Mm.
A friend. It was signed a friend.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, well, that's nice. It's odd. I don't know where it came from, but that was nice. I had no idea that I was a part of this this art exhibit, let alone by the great Ai Weiwei, who had done my portrait out of Legos.
Yes, yes.
And the next day I got about 600, and then the third day I got another 600. And I ended up getting a little bit more than 2,000 of these postcards. Many of them were signed. Several were from former CIA colleagues telling me that I had done the right thing.
Wow.
And the way that these postcards just turn around your mood, it was miraculous. The reason that he did this was that Weiwei's father was arrested imprisoned in the 1950s because of a poem that he had written. Mm. He was arrested by Mao's government in China, and he was sent to exile in far northeastern China. And he had mentioned to Weiwei, once he had gotten out of prison, that that the only joy he had in life was receiving postcards from people who had read and appreciated his poetry.
Yes.
And so Weiwei did this beautiful, wonderful exhibit at Alcatraz, where he created portraits of 198 prisoners of conscience around the world out of Legos, and invited the 864,000 people who went through the exhibit to send postcards to people all around the world.
Yes. It was amazing speaking with the director of the documentary and to learn more about his story, and now to be connected with you. That sort of completes the circle, if you will. I guess it's safe to say both of you were political prisoners.
It's funny, I never thought of myself as a political prisoner.
No.
I had to sort of be told and convinced that I was a political prisoner. In retrospect, I was, from the beginning.
Okay, we're going to have to go, John, but before we do, tell us a bit more at least about your book, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. Doing Time Like a Spy, now that's a loaded, top-heavy, you know why I say that, but tell us about that and then how we get the book and what do you want us to take away from this conversation?
Thank you. Yeah, I called it Doing Time Like a Spy because in sentencing, my attorneys asked my judge to send me to a minimum security work camp.
Mm.
There are no fences, no bars on the windows, no locks on the doors. You're free to come and go as you please. You're just on your honor not to abscond.
Mm-hmm.
Most people work in town at the local university, and she agreed to send me to this minimum security work camp. And what you do is, you drive up to the prison. Work camps are usually located across the street from the actual prison.
Uh-huh.
You just drive up to it and turn yourself in. And so on my date, I drove up and turned myself in. And instead of sending me to the camp, they sent me to the actual prison.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, I'm supposed to be across the street at the camp. And the guard laughed and said, not according to my paperwork, you're not. And so it took me 5 days before I got access to a phone, and I called my attorneys, and I said, hey, they put me in the actual prison with the drug kingpins and the mafia dons and the pedophiles. What do I do? And he said, wow, well, he said, I'm sorry, buddy. We could file a motion, but it'll be 2 years before we get a hearing, and you'll be home by then. You're going to have to just tough it out. And so I decided to fall back on my CIA training to make sure that I remain safe and at the top of the social heap. And so the book's starts, the book is partly tongue-in-cheek. It's these 20 life lessons the CIA taught me and how I used those life lessons to manipulate people to keep myself safe. But then the other half of the book is a serious look at prison and prison life and prison reform and how the guards are just as much imprisoned in there as the inmates are.
Yes, yes. There's many ways of being in prison, that's for sure. John Kiriakou. What an amazing conversation this has been. A former CIA analyst, you know, case officer, former, and, you know, we've been through, it's a whole program just listing what you have done in your life. And what's now for you? Your wife, 5 children, you've all gone through this. You have books out and, again, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. What do you want us to take away from this conversation today? Well, how do you want us to remember you, think of you? What's next?
Thank you. I hope that people will think of me as a freedom fighter. That's what it's all about. There's a lot of work to do, whether it's prison reform or sentencing reform or justice reform. There's a lot of work to do, and we have to work together to get it done.
Yes. All right. My hero, John Kiriakou. Thank you so much, John, for all you're doing, all you've done. And I hope everyone who hears this will pass it out as a rippling effect. Send it all over social media. Let people know that there are Americans who are still fighting for what we say we are. How's that, John?
That sounds great. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye now and all the best.
Take care.
You too.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. As a child, Philippe Petit loved the thrill. It became his dream to walk a wire between the highest towers in the world. In Man on Wire, we get to accompany Philippe on one of the greatest wire walks ever, his 1974 assault on the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center. Seeing the film now, we can never put out of our consciousness the haunting image of the towers, nor escape the impact of the 9/11 tragedy. But far from tainting the experience, our memories give it a poignant added dimension. Using the technique of intertwining both staged and actual images, director James Marsh has created an extraordinarily realistic thriller. We accompany the guerrilla-like team as they plan the assault, illegally enter the buildings, evade the guards, and rig the wire. And then, magically, Philippe steps out on his 200-foot steel cable, where for 45 minutes he cavorted and danced 1,350 feet above the streets of Manhattan. Whether we think him daring or insane, he is an artist who provides a transformative event that we are blessed to share with him in Man on Wire. Petit was found guilty of disturbing the peace for opening the door to dreams. Indie Film Minute. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the Reasonable Voices heard round the world. Usually at this point in our programs, I read something I have written. But in this new year, 2020, year of impeachment and potential war, potential forever wars, never fought by the men who send our youth. This poem was written by a Marine and sent to a friend of mine who forwarded it on to me. As a veteran, as a patriot, as an American, as a human being, I now share it with you. It was the night before Christmas. He lived all alone in a one-bedroom house made of plaster and stone. I had come down the chimney with presents to give, and to see just who in this home did live. I looked all about, a strange sight I did see, no tinsel, no presents, not even a tree. No stocking by mantle, just boots filled with sand, on the wall hung pictures of far distant lands. With medals and badges, awards of all kinds, a sober thought came through my mind. For this house was different. It was dark and dreary. I found the home of a soldier, once I could see clearly. The soldier lay sleeping, silent, alone, curled up on the floor in this one-bedroom home. The face was gentle, the room in such disorder, not how I pictured a United States soldier. Was this the hero of whom I just read, curled up on a poncho, the floor for a bed? I realize the families that I saw this night owed their lives to these soldiers who were willing to fight. Soon round the world the children would play and grown-ups would celebrate a bright Christmas day. They all enjoyed freedom each month of the year because of the soldiers like the one lying here. I couldn't help wonder how many lay alone on a Christmas Eve in a land far from home. The very thought brought a tear to my eye. I dropped my knees and started to cry. The soldier awakened and I heard a rough voice. Santa, don't cry. This life is my choice. I fight for freedom. I don't ask for more. My life is my God, my country, my core. The soldier rolled over and drifted to sleep. I couldn't control it. I continued to weep. I kept watch for hours, so silent and still, and we both shivered from the cold night's chill. I didn't want to leave on that cold, dark night, this guardian of honor so willing to fight. Then the soldier rolled over with a voice soft and pure, whispered, "Carry on, Santa. It's Christmas Day. All is secure." One look at my watch, and I knew he was right. Merry Christmas, my friend, and to all a good night. This poem was written by a Marine. The following is his request. I think it is reasonable. Please do your part to plant this seed of kindness instead of rancor, of unity instead of chaos, and of world peace instead of war. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.